want to share with you something from my past that happened in my hometown of Sydney. Sydney was host to the Olympic Games in the year 2000. And here's something you may not know about me. It's not on my resume, but I actually participated in the 2000 Sydney Olympics. What event, I hear you asking yourselves. Well, I'll give you a hint. It wasn't women's weightlifting. I was actually a peon in the opening ceremony. I was one of those little pixels of highly costumed color and movement that they use to create the great impression for the broadcast that's going to be beamed all around the world. And it was fun to be a mere pixel for a night. My particular job was to be sort of part of a human grid that contained and controlled the 10,500 athletes who march onto the field in the wonderful Parade of Nations. While those kids haven't been on that field before, they don't get a chance to rehearse, so somebody has to get them where they need to be. And the wonderful choreographers of the Olympics have figured out this moving grid that kind of shoves and moves them so that there's a lovely pattern at the end when they're all on there. So you're sort of like a highly costumed sheepdog with choreography. So there's a lot of rituals that go along with the Olympic Games. There's certain things that you have to have at every game that was decided, you know, at the inception of the modern Olympics. And one thing that you have to have is the dove as the symbol of peace. And traditionally at Olympics for many, many decades, they would release live doves, and that's all very lovely, until the Barcelona Olympics, when the doves did a circuit of the stadium and then all decided that the crater-like Olympic torch was a really terrific perch. And they all went and sat there. Well, fortunately, the torch had not yet been lit. But great consternation and much scuffling around to shoo the doves off so that the scent of roasted peace duff didn't permeate the stadium. So the ceremonies director at the Sydney Olympics noted that and took a lesson and decided to go a slightly different way. He decided that he would do something quite extraordinary. So once all the athletes were assembled on the field of play, an immense white flag suddenly appeared and was drawn right across the enormous stadium over the heads of all the athletes, and on this flag was projected doves of light. And everybody who saw it said it was really beautiful. Well, I didn't see it because I was under it. I was under there with 10,500 athletes of the world in a suddenly very intimate space. And I looked around. And I was very near the nations that started with I. And Iran was there. And Iraq was right next to them. And I was struck by that because not that many years earlier I had been covering the 8-year-long wall between Iran and Iraq. And I'd been on the battlefield on the Four Peninsula where young teenage bodies, gassed or shot, were being mashed into the sand, their identities lost to their families forever. And what a change to see these young athletes from Iran and Iraq standing together under this banner of peace doves. Next to them was Israel. Not very far away across the field was the very tiny delegation of athletes from Palestine. And I looked at them. I'd covered the First Intifada, and I thought, I don't know if those Palestinians were part of the young Shabab throwing rocks, but I do know that some of those Israeli athletes served in the military that was charged with suppressing that uprising. But here they are under this flag of peace doves. And there was Burundi, and there was Bosnia and Herzegovina, North and South Korea standing together. Young athletes who had grown up in conflicts all over the world. Young faces all looking upward at this beautiful blur of light, the blurry image of the doves, and all together under this banner of peace. And it was a really, really beautiful moment in my life. And I thought, maybe we're here. It's the year 2000. It's the dawn of a new millennium. And the world is as much at peace on this day in September as at any time in the last century. Maybe we've done it. And I allow myself to hope. Well, we barely got to the end of the Olympics when there was news from Israel that there was trouble on the Temple Mount and the Second Intifada had erupted. And then, of course, the year turned, and the following September, the World Trade Centers came down in New York City, and here we are again, a world at war, and endless, endless enemies, and no end in sight to bloodshed and conflict and violence. What is it with us? As a species, we prove over and over again that we are capable of making peace with each other. A young man will be sent to drop bombs on a village in Vietnam. A peace treaty will be signed, and then that young man, as a middle-aged man, will be back there talking to his former enemies, maybe helping them build a school or a hospital. We can do it. We know we can do it. Era after era, we put together these fantastic civilizations where difference is celebrated. And every time we do that, we move the creative ball forward. We extend our minds in intellectual pursuits. Science takes leaps. The arts take a leap. And then what happens? We smash it apart. I think about Convivencia Spain, that period when Muslims and Christians and Jews lived together. They had pavilions of the book there where books would be translated from Hebrew into Latin, from Arabic into the proto-Spanish language of the day. It was a rich society with beautiful gardens and evenings where poetry was recited and science prospered. And then uprises the Inquisition, the fear of otherness. The Muslims and the Jews are driven off and expelled. And the society impoverishes itself. You could say that Spain has never really climbed back from that mistake of demonizing otherness. And yet we do it again and again in the 20th century, pre-war Germany, a place of great intellectual exchange. Sarajevo, a model city where people of difference had lived together for centuries. And yet always those people come who want to say the other is different, the other is unacceptable, the other must be killed. Rush to conflict. Snatch the hot satisfactions of violence. What is the cure for it? Is literature a vaccine for this terrible disease that we have as a species? I like to think it is. I like to think it is because the people who are the enemies of peace are afraid of it. Why else did the National Library of Bosnia, why did it fall victim to deliberate targeting by phosphorus bombs until almost every book that couldn't be carried out at great risk to librarians, who some of whom gave their lives that night? Why do jailers try so hard to keep books out of prisoners' hands? I knew a young man in Palestine who was imprisoned during the First Intifada. He loved English more than anything. He wanted to learn English, so I took him a copy of The Old Man and the Sea, thinking that Hemingway's spare language would be something that he could manage and enjoy. But his jailers wouldn't allow him to have it. There was a young Australian man who was captured on the battlefields of Afghanistan called David Hicks. And he was incarcerated in Guantanamo Bay. And the jailers there knew very well the power of the written word. He had a remarkable military lawyer, a young Marine, assigned to him who became passionate about a fair trial for this young Australian Taliban, as he was termed. And so he would try to bring him books. He tried to bring him To Kill a Mockingbird, but the jailers wouldn't let him have it. And furthermore, they so feared the power of the written word that when David Hicks was allowed to get a rare letter from his family at home, they redacted the word love from the letter. So the despots and the jailers know that words are powerful. We have to know too, we who write them and we who read them. My work is very much, not so much deliberately, but just something that comes up from my heart, committed to the idea that what unites us always, always is greater than what divides us. And many people take exception to that. There's a very famous letter that Henry James wrote to a novelist in Maine named Sarah Orne Jewett, who had written a historical novel. And James said that any attempt to write about a period more than 50 years removed from one's own was worthless and shouldn't even be attempted. He said, you can take the little facts, as get as many as you like, but the consciousness of people who lived in the past is unobtainable because the things that make our modern world didn't exist for them. So when I read that letter of Henry James, I thought, geez, and I went and poured myself a gin and tonic. And I went and looked up Sarah Orne Jewett because I wondered how she'd taken that, and I found that that novel she'd sent to James was the last she'd ever written. And I thought, oh, maybe he discouraged her from following her craft. But then I read further and found that she'd died. She'd been in a carriage accident soon after that correspondence, and she'd died not long after that. And I started to imagine Sarah and the carriage and the slide of horses' hooves on slippery Maine mud and the disarray of starched skirts as she flew into the air and the crunch of breaking bones as she landed. And I thought, a pox on you, Henry James, because this is what we do. We put ourselves in someone's shoes, and I think I can imagine her pain and her fear, her frustration at not being able to write, her terror of her life being cut short, because our consciousness isn't shaped by things. It's not the furniture. It's not the fact that, you know, in a difficult delivery we use forceps now instead of a Thatcher's hook, which is what they would have used. The salient thing in that scene is the mother's fear that her baby's life is at risk, that her life is at risk. It's strong emotions that shape us as people. As a journalist, I heard the same thing over and over again. They're not like us. Israelis would say it about Palestinians. Palestinians would say it about Israelis. Black Africans about white, whites about blacks. And it was never true, not once. The sound of a mother keening for a dead child is exactly the same in a well-appointed salon in Manhattan as it is in a refugee camp in Eritrea. And we have to remember that. We have to remember that what brings us together is the most important thing. And we can't let the voices that want to demonize the other be strong. We have to be the ones in our generation who stand up against it, wherever it is, whether it's in southern Sudan or lower Manhattan. We have to find our common identity, because the human heart remains the human heart, no matter how our material circumstances or our race or our class or our gender are defined by others. I always think about my late neighbor on Martha's Vineyard, William Styron, who wrote the book The Confessions of Nat Turner, who was taken to the woodshed by a number of African-American writers as a white southern man presuming to think his way into the head of the leader of the slave uprising. And actually it was James Baldwin who sprang to his defense who spoke up against this idea that you should have an apartheid of the imagination. And what Baldwin said has been my clarion call and the thing that enables me to do my work. And he said, each of us, helplessly and forever, contains the other, male and female, black and white, white and black. I would add Christian and Jew, Jew and Muslim, any, all, and each of us. And thank you for this prize that recognizes that this is where peace has to begin. Thank you.
Some pixel. Remarkable. We're coming to the close of the evening, as you well know, and we're going to be closing with music. I have just one thought that actually Ben took care of earlier. I will add to it only this. A corner of the world that I personally have grown to love, and the people there particularly I've grown to love in Africa, are approaching this 9th of January. So I'm going to offer you a great gift. It's a gift from actually all of us, and you are peculiarly, I think it is peculiarly appropriate that you accept this gift because I think you know what to do with it. I offer you this. On the 9th of January, there will be a referendum in South Sudan. It will be either a great new beginning and a great new morning for Sudan, or it could be the opening of another of the terrible cataract of civil wars that have struck that nation and have taken now literally millions of lives over the last 20 years, most recently in the western part of Sudan in Darfur. But before that, long before that, for 20 years, a constant battle between the north and the south that may be reignited. It can be stopped. It can be stopped by us. It was, in fact, before, at least ameliorated by us. And so I offer you this gift. There was a time when those of us of a certain age saw on those screens the movies of the 1940s. We saw those pajamas over frail bodies, people we knew were going to die before we left the theater. Didn't know what they were. We didn't call it anything yet. We didn't call it the Holocaust. We didn't know what to call it. But we said this. Why didn't somebody tell me? Why didn't you tell me? I'd have fixed it. Then when I was a young reporter, it was Cambodia. Remember the pyramids of skulls? Remember? And what they looked like? And we said, why didn't you tell me? I'd have done some. Bosnia, Herzegovina, the slit trenches and the hundreds and then in the thousands of bodies. Why didn't you tell me before? Look, you're telling me afterwards. It's no help. The apocalyptic 90 days in Rwanda. Why didn't we know? Well, we were never able to stop one of these before it started, because we didn't know that we were on the edge of the precipice. Now you know. God bless you all. And thank you for this great evening.